In 1989, engineer and scientist Maurice Cottrell found a way of calculating the duration of long-term magnetic reversals on the sun. Using this knowledge, he was able to break the codes of ancient sun-worshipping civilizations. First, the Mayas of Central America, and then those of Tutankhamun of Egypt. His research explains how the sun affects fertility in women, how it determines personality of the fetus in the womb, how it regulates menstruation. It explains how the sun causes schizophrenia, how overhead power lines, he says, cause cancer, how VDUs, which are TV and computer screens, sometimes can cause miscarriages, and explains how the sun brings periodic catastrophic destruction to Earth every few thousand years. Think about all that. His own unique decoding process reveals amazing pictures from archaeological treasures that explain the spiritual mysteries of life, why we're born, why we die, and why this simply has to be. His work, best described as adventure fact, brings together modern science, spirituality, and ancient wisdom to unlock the secrets of the past, the present, and the future. Maurice Cottrell, back on Coast to Coast. Hi, Maurice. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Always a pleasure to talk with you, my friend.
Thank you.
Where have your travels taken you recently? You been going anywhere?
Well, yes. I've been to China to investigate the ancient Chinese civilizations, and in particular that of Qin Shi Huangdi, the first emperor. And I was persuaded to go to China after writing The Lost Tomb of Viracocha, because there were certain parallels between the Peruvian civilization and the Mayas and ancient China which needed investigating. So I've spent some time there. I'm also living in Ireland at the moment, working on a book about the Celts, the Celtic Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
So again, another sun-worshipping civilization. So, keeping busy as always.
Well, you enjoy, I think, unraveling some of the mysteries of ancient civilizations. And I know when you had sent me almost a year ago the different types of pictures, when you fold them over and under, it was just amazing at literally how the ancient civilizations left messages behind. How long did it take you to kind of decipher some of those things?
It was an awfully long time, and it didn't help because we didn't have the technology at the time in the late 80s and early 90s. Computer programs were very slow. Memory capacity was very small and limited. And I had to do a lot of things by hand over and over again because color photocopiers hadn't really appeared on the market. But once we got the technology, once the color photocopiers were available, once the speed of the software was increased about 1993 and the capabilities of the software, the discoveries started to unfold at an ever-increasing rate. And, I mean, one could argue that it's taken me a lifetime to get to where I am today, and it's been a steady and systematic approach to investigating how ancient civilizations could have been much cleverer than we are today. The initial pictures of which you speak, the Maya transformers, I call them.
Uh-huh.
These pictures that transform into many other pictures once you start the decoding process. The first picture took, I think it was about 10 months of 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. And as I began to understand the rules of encoding and what they were doing, the time gradually speeded up to 6 months, 3 months, 2 weeks, and now I can do a picture in about 3 days.
Oh, that's amazing. And I want you to realize that you can go to Maurice's website and take a look at a few of the pictures that we're talking about right now. When you first saw these, were they originally on like sculptures first? They were like on tablets and things like that?
Yes, once I started to inquire into ancient civilizations and how they could possibly have understood the magnetic cycles of the sun, it became clear that they were far cleverer than we are. So when I went down to their ceremonial center in Palenque in Mexico in 1989, I started to look at the carvings with a completely different view of, rather than being carved by savages, as some archaeologists would wish us to believe, I began to consider that they might actually be creations of genius and started to look at them, as I said, in a completely different way. And one of the first things I noticed about the sarcophagus lid of Lord Peikau, the priest-king leader of the Mayas,
mm-hmm.
who died around AD 750 in Palenque, was that two corners of his tombstone lid were missing, which was odd, to say the least, because it was such a beautiful carving. It was 12 feet long by 7 feet wide, and it weighed 5 tons, an ornately carved block of limestone.
5 tons?
Yes, 5 tons.
Okay.
And it's still in the pyramid to this day. It was so large, the archaeologists couldn't remove it from the small triangular door to the tomb. I asked the archaeologists where the missing corners might have been, and they hadn't even noticed they were missing. And very sadly, they'd actually manufactured a copy of the lid of Palenque, the coffin lid, and it's now in the museum at Palenque. And it's hard to believe this, but the archaeologists have taken it upon themselves to reinstate the missing corners. They've actually built up the corners which are missing.
Yeah.
And it's very sad, because without the missing corners, you can't begin the decoding process. And quite simply, what they were saying was, by leaving two pieces of the puzzle missing, is that nobody could ever understand 100% what the carving was all about. It stands to reason, if two pieces are missing, we could never know what were on those two pieces.
Mm.
And therefore, the most important thing, as far as I could see, was in order to have an efficacious interpretation of what might be on the lid, it would be foolhardy to start with only 98% of the information. And so I started to look for the missing corners. And once I started to look for the missing corners, I found a way of finding them. And from that moment on, it was all downhill.
What do you mean by it was all downhill?
Well, once I realized that the corners could be reinstated almost by putting a mirror at the end of the coffin lid, then I realized that one way of fixing the corners, if you like, was to make a transparency, because mirrors almost worked, but I couldn't overlay the corners exactly on top of each other.
I see.
I would only get a mirror image. So that led me on to making transparencies. And when I put the transparencies on top of each other and overlaid them, I could see secret pictures in the border code around the lid, a pattern of codes around the lid. And further examination, once I started to color these pictures in, led to pictorial instructions. They were like totem poles around the edges of the lid. And those instructions later turned out to be a list of contents of a book, the ancient Bible of the Mayas, which is actually encoded into the tombstone.
Did you do this by accident? Did you, like, accidentally hold up the transparencies to a mirror? Or did you know, hey, I'm going to try this?
It was a case of, not really, I'm going to try this. It was a logical progression each step of the way. You see, the Mayas, Maya is an ancient Sanskrit word, some say going back 16,000 BC, that's 18,000 years ago. And it means illusion. And the race of the Mayas in Palenque preached that this life was indeed illusion, that what we can see is meaningless. And the most important things of life are the things we can't see, the spiritual side of life. And in other words, they were trying to say that what is good becomes bad and what is bad becomes good. Now, from a philosophical perspective, that seems strange to a Westerner. But if we just pause for a moment and think about perhaps the worst day of our lives, when we had some bad news, maybe somebody died, a friend or family member, and we remember those tearful moments, lying on the carpet, perhaps crying our eyes out, and we thought we'd never escape from that awful moment, and yet, sitting here tonight looking back, we did escape and we recovered, and, you know, we've gotten over it. If we now look at perhaps one of the nicest moments of our life, where we were, I don't know, young and carefree, without a care in the world, and we had a partner, and the day was sunny, and love was in the air, and now we come back to today, where we are this evening, listening to this program, we're not quite as happy as we were in those days. So what was bad has made us feel good, and what was good makes us feel bad later on. So everything's backwards. Everything is a mirror image as far as the Maya mind is concerned. And they were trying to express a notion which teaches us to reorganize our misplaced values, and instead of concentrating on the material, to concentrate on the spiritual.
What happened to them, Maurice? There are some that are now saying that because of tremendous climatic changes, it wiped them out. And then others say, no, that had nothing to do with it. What do you think happened to the Maya?
Well, the evidence is quite clear. Once we start to decode the artifacts of the Mayas and investigate their understanding of the sun's magnetic fields, we now know from my research that the sun affects fertility on Earth, the magnetic cycles of the sun. And we also know that there are cycles spanning thousands of years into the future and the past, which had to be monitored by the Mayas, because it was very important. The Maya calendar, paradoxically, begins in 3113 BC. I say paradoxically because the Mayas themselves didn't appear till about AD 100, which is 3,200 years later. Now, why would they use a calendar when they didn't even exist? Well, in the Dresden Codex, there are pages and pages of observations of the planet Venus, which has an interval with respect to the Earth of 584 days. So if we look at Venus, we'll see it in the same position in the sky with relation to the Sun every 584 days. And the Mayas believe that that date in 3113 BC was the birth of Venus. And what they were trying to tell us was that periodically, and we now know from my calculations, it's every 3,740 years, we now know that the solar magnetic field, the neutral sheet, or the magnetic field around the equator, flips every 3,740 years. And when this happens, we get a disruption to fertility on Earth. Now, we've only just begun to understand how this could possibly work.
Is it a huge disruption? Obviously.
It's a massive disruption, absolutely. And as I said, we're only coming to terms with this ourselves, with our own technology. As recently as 1962, Mariner 2 spacecraft detected particles coming from the sun, and scientists soon began to describe this phenomenon as the solar wind. And then they started to discuss how the solar wind showered the Earth with these positive and negative particles. And in 1979, a British physicist, Ian Nicholson, discovered that when the particles bombard the Earth's magnetic shroud, the Van Allen belt,
right,
which encircle the Earth, the magnetic field of the Earth varies in sympathy. And in 1984, it was Ross Ader, who was the White House chief medical advisor during the Reagan administration.
Mm-hmm.
He did some experiments on rats, guinea pigs, and pigeons, and noticed that when the brain was bombarded by alternating magnetic fields, similar to what was occurring from this solar wind bombardment, then the brains of those creatures started to produce more or less melatonin, which is a timing hormone. And we now know that melatonin affects the biorhythms and the production of the follicle-stimulating hormone and the luteinizing hormone.
That's what lets you sleep, too, or gets your time, I guess, your mental clock together.
That's absolutely correct. Now, those two hormones I mentioned, the follicle-stimulating hormone and the luteinizing hormone, go on to affect the generation of estrogen and progesterone, the fertility hormones. And what we now know is that every month the sun spins. In fact, the sun spins every 28 days, and this is why it showers these particles towards the Earth. It's like a water sprinkler. And every 28 days, the magnetic field of the Earth changes. The magnetic field bathes the brains of living organisms, including females, humans on Earth.
You think that's why females have that monthly cycle?
This is why females menstruate every 28 days.
Interesting.
And there are other cycles, longer-term cycles, 12 years, 48 years, 187 years, 3,740 years, and 18,139 years. And the ancients were aware of this. And they were trying to tell us that, going back to the birth of Venus date, that the sun's magnetic field flipped in 3,113 BC. Now, the planets are magnetically coupled to that. The magnetic field is magnetically coupled to that of the sun. So when the sun's field flips, the planets, if the magnetic twist is strong enough, have a propensity to turn upside down on the axis. So that everything on Earth would be destroyed in such a case.
Now, how did they know this?
Well,
I didn't want to throw you such a baffling question there, Maurice. Huh?
No, it's not baffling. It's just very involved. And it took me years to come to terms with all of this information.
I mean, did they get help? Let me just rule this in or out. Did they get help?
Yes, they did. They were taught by a super teacher. And I call these super teachers super gods who come to Earth periodically to teach mankind the higher orders of science and spirituality.
Because there's no way they could have learned this on their own, I don't think.
I doubt it, but then again, I've learned it on my own. But that is because I've had a scientific approach, a scientific inquiry. And it would appear that I was familiar with it before I was born in this incarnation. Let me put it that way. Because, I mean, we've got a long program and we have a lot of things to discuss.
Sure.
And reincarnation will be one of them later on. And it seems to be that a lot of people, including the people on the Art Bell Show and your listeners tonight, are once again coming to terms with this information, which we were aware of thousands of years ago. And it's in our psyche and we know it's there. And it's a question of discovering it. But it's only now with our technology that we've ever been able to understand exactly what's going on.
Something keeps or seems to be drawing it into us, Maurice. You're right. I can't explain it. I can't. But there does seem to be some kind of connection, some force, some higher power that is starting to tie a lot of people in with this.
Absolutely. And the books that I've written over the past 12 years explain exactly what this power is. And as you mentioned on the introduction, why we're born, why we die, why this has to be, what God is, what time is, what hell is, and so on. And again, not wishing to run before we can walk, it's probably better just to take things slowly, because the issues, although they're complex, can be simplified. But it does take a rational and pedestrian approach rather than a galloping one, which would just exhaust us. And if I could just go back to 3,130.
Yeah, go ahead for now. We got a break coming up, but I'll go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. It seems that at that time, the sun's magnetic field flipped, and Venus, being much closer to the sun than the Earth, flipped on its axis. It turned upside down, because the Maya described the event as the birth of Venus as a night when the whole sky was lit up with the sunlight reflected from the Venusian carbon dioxide poles. The light showered across the heavens as it turned upside down.
What a sight that must have been.
Absolutely.
My gosh.
And this seems to explain why Venus is spinning upside down now in the opposite direction to all the other planets.
Well, that's right. You're absolutely right.
And, of course, it spins very, very slowly now. So it's slowing down before it starts to spin in the other direction. It would seem through a mechanism of induction whereby the solar wind creates the magnetic fields on the planets. The planetary magnetic fields start to interact with that of the sun. The planets start to orbit the sun and spin on its planets. This is all part of the evolution of the solar system and galaxy formations and so on.
Does this change come quickly or slowly?
Generally speaking, it reaches a critical mass. The change comes slowly. It takes 187 years for this magnetic change to sweep across the Earth to reach a maximum, then another 187 years to sweep past again. So there's like a trough. But clearly, in many of these mechanisms, there's a critical mass is achieved at a certain point, and then the change comes virtually instantaneously within seconds.
And then what it does, what a catastrophe. Stay with us. My guest, Maurice Cutrell. We're talking about not only Mayan prophecy, but there's all kinds of things that he has come across in his ancient civilizations and his quest for the truth. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Maurice, let's talk a little bit. So many things I want to talk with you about, including, of course, the help from extraterrestrials and reincarnation. But in your most recent book, The Lost Tomb of Viracocha, let's talk a little bit about that word. Who is, what is Viracocha?
Well, the word first came to the attention of Westerners when the conquistadors invaded Peru in 1532. And the soldiers started to ask the Incas how they could possibly have built the wonderful stone monuments and buildings that were all around them. How could they have lifted these colossal stones into the air and piled them on top of each other without the use of mechanical lifting equipment? And the Incas just shrugged their shoulders and extended their arms and their hands and sort of looked skywards and said it was their ancestors. And we have quite a few accounts of the conversations that took place between the conquistadors and the Incas at the time.
See, this is better evidence than the Egyptians, and that's why this is so fascinating.
I agree, absolutely. In fact, one of the commentators was called Garcilaso Inca de la Vega. He was actually born in Cusco in 1540, the son of a Spaniard who arrived in 1534 from Spain. And his mother was a Peruvian royal princess.
Mm-hmm.
And he published a book, part one, the Commentary Reales, in 1609. And another commentator, Cieza de Leon, who was a Spaniard by birth but visited Peru from the age of 13 onwards, wrote his Chronicles of Peru, which were published in 1550. And these are just a couple of the many accounts that we have of the stories that were coming out of the Incas at that time. And I'd just like to read a couple of these.
Yes, please.
Book, in fact. One of them concerns from Garcilaso Inca de la Vega about how a white man walked among the Mochica performing miracles and then left. And the story says that our father, the sun, sent down two children to Lake Titicaca, 80 leagues from Cusco, and told them to pass where they would, and wherever they stayed to eat or sleep, they should sink in the soil a rod of gold, which he gave to them. The rod was half a yard long and was to serve as a sign, for where it sank into the earth with a single blow, that's where they were to stop and found the sacred city of the sun. Another, this one was by Father Jose de Acosta, says the Indians say that all men were drowned in the deluge, and they report that out of Great Lake Titicaca came one Viracocha, who stayed in Tiwanaku, where to this day there seem to be the ruins of ancient and very strange buildings. And from there came to Cusco, and so began mankind to multiply. Now, the word Viracocha, as we'll see in a second from another account, this time from a commentator called Juan de Santa Cruz Pachacuti Yamquit Salcamahuea, an account of the antiquities of Peru.
What a name that was, huh?
It certainly is a mouthful.
A mouthful, yeah.
He quotes this story, which is very interesting. Before the Incas ruled, or had even been heard of in these kingdoms, the Indians relate a thing more noteworthy than anything else. They say that there suddenly appeared, coming from the south, a white man of large stature and authoritative demeanor. This man had such great power that he changed the hills into valleys, and from the valleys made great hills, causing streams to flow from the living stone. When they saw his power, they called him Maker of all things created, and Prince of all things, Father of the Sun. For he did other still more wonderful things, giving being to men and animals. By his hand, very great benefits accrued to them. This is the story that the Indians told me themselves, and they heard it from their fathers, who in turn heard it from the old songs which were handed down from ancient times. They say that this man travelled along the highland route to the north, working marvels as he went. They say they never saw him again. They say that in many places he gave men instructions on how they should live, speaking to them with great love and kindness, and admonishing them to be good and to do no damage or injury one to the other, but to love one another and show charity to all. In most places they call him Tiki Viracocha. In many places they built temples to him, and in them they set up statues in his likeness and offered sacrifices before them. The huge statues in the village of Tiwanaku are held to be from those ancient times. After much time had passed, they saw another man, like in appearance to the first, but they don't mention his name. They have it from forebears that wherever he passed, he healed all that were sick and restored sight to the blind by words alone.
Incredible.
Thus he was loved by everybody. So working great miracles by his words, he came to the district of Canis, and there, near the village of Kasha, the people rose up against him and threatened to stone him. They saw him sink to his knees and raise his hands to heaven, as if beseeching aid in the peril which beset him. The Indians declare that thereupon they saw fire in the sky, which seemed all around them. Full of fear, they approached him whom they had intended to kill, and besought him to forgive them, for they regarded this as a punishment for their sin in seeking to stone a stranger. Presently, they saw that the fire was extinguished at his command. Though the stones were consumed by fire in such a way that large blocks could be lifted by hand as if they were cork. They say further that leaving the place where this occurred, he came to the coast, and there, holding his mantle, went forth amidst the waves of the sea and was seen no more. And as he went, they gave him the name Viracocha, which in their language means foam of the sea.
Mm.
Now, I was a bit perplexed as to why they should call a spiritual leader who could perform miracles Viracocha.
Yeah.
And I was paddling in the beach one day in my rubber boots in Cornwall, considering the question. And I had the waves lapping over my feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that I had the earth beneath my feet, the water over my feet, the wind in my hair, and the sun in my face. And that was the only time I was in communion with all of the elements, earth, air, fire, water, simultaneously.
Right.
In other words, I was in a state of perfection, of communion with the earth, with the Creator. So it seems that the word Viracocha is a metaphor for the perfect being. Another story from Juan de Santa Cruz says this: I asked them what their tradition had to tell about the appearance of Viracocha when he was seen by the first men of their race. They told me he was a man of tall stature, clothed in white robes, which came down to his feet, which he wore belted at the waist. He had short hair and tonsure like a priest. He went unshod and carried in his hands a thing which, in the light of what they know today, they liken to the breviaries which priests carry. And I asked them what was the name of the person in whose honor that stone was set up. They told me it was Contiki Viracocha Pachacamac, which in their language means God of the world. So, if we start to look at their accounts, we get a picture of two men, two white men, who walked the lands of Peru, and we now know it was about the time of AD 100 and AD 300, and they walked from Lake Titicaca along the coast through Nazca up to northwest Peru to an area of Saipan, and that's where they were, ostensibly, where they disappeared into the waves, the foam of the sea.
And very similar accounts to, of course, Jesus and what he did in the Middle Eastern region of the world. Very
Absolutely.
Similar.
And we see many parallels between these religious leaders, these spiritual leaders, which appear throughout history. And indeed, a previous book of mine considered the question of where this super intelligence might be coming from, this miraculous intelligence which allows people to heal by touch or words alone.
Well, do you believe that we're talking about different people or different beings or one and the same?
Well, the evidence suggests that it's the same spiritual energy. Now, I say this because they've all of these spiritual leaders have left the same information encoded in their treasures.
Yes.
for peoples of the future. And what we see is that from the decoded treasures of the Maya, we are told that Lord Peikal also walked the lands of Peru many years ago. One particular treasure, the Sun Shield of Monte Olban, which is a disc, ostensibly, of Zapotec origin in Mexico. When we overlay the Sun Shield, we see pictures that show Lord Peikal in Peru at Lake Titicaca. We see Lord Peikal inside a Vesica Pisces at Lake Titicaca. Now, the Vesica Pisces is associated with Christianity and Christ. It refers to the fish, the shape of the fish, which is made by two overlaid circles.
Right.
And it seems that the reason it's associated with Christianity is because when Christ appeared, the procession cycle featured Pisces, the fish, whereas before that, during, for example, Egyptian times, it featured Ares the ram during Tutankhamun's time, and also 2,000 years earlier, Apis the bull. So it seems that the ancients used astronomical indicators which would be unchanging throughout time, for example, astronomical constants, to tell us about these spiritual teachers.
Well, and it seems so like, unlike Christ, it looks like these two may have escaped with their lives when they merely disappeared?
I wouldn't say escape with their lives. What happens if we examine the evidence is that the two great sun kings of Peru, Viracocha and Viracocha Pachacamac, mm-hmm. AD 100 and 300, it looks now like they were buried in the pyramids, which archaeologists discovered in 1988.
They were buried? Okay.
They were buried. And this is why it can't be the same guy, because we have bodies in pyramids in Peru giving this information, and we have bodies or bones in Mexico of Lord Peikau, who also left the same information, but it was 500 years before.
Ah, all right.
So it can't possibly be the same physical incarnation. But because the information is identical, it must be the same spiritual energy, which is coming back over and over again throughout history. And again, once we start to examine the information, we find lots of parallels, not just one or two, but many, many parallels between all the religious leaders of mankind. And we can go back to Krishna, which etymologically it has a lot in common with Christ or Christos. And Krishna. Krishna was the an incarnation of Vishnu, and Vishnu in turn was one of the Hindu, or Brahmin, before the Hindus, Holy Trinity. We have Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. So Vishnu was said to reincarnate many times. The eighth time is Krishna, and Krishna reincarnated the ninth time as Buddha. Now that's accepted and it's understood in Brahmin understanding. So we have a link here between Krishna, Buddha, and Christ. Now, we also know that these teachers were the sons of God, and Tutankhamun is the son of God, who also lived in Egypt, and he taught his people the super signs of the sun, just like the Viracochas of Central America and Lord Peikau of the Mayas. If we start to decode the pictures of Lord Peikau that he left around 750 AD, not just the amazing lid of Palenque, the coffin lid, but if we start looking at the jewelry, the mosaic mask that covered the face of the dead man in the tomb and decode that, that also contains pictures. If we look at the paintings of the Mayas from the hidden temples in the jungle at Bonampak, then we see other encoded pictures. And the pictures tell us that Lord Peikau was the reincarnation of Christ many years ago. It tells us that he was born in a stable, that he grew up to be a white man with a beard who died on the cross, and that he produced miracles. It tells us that in a previous incarnation, he was Buddha and Tutankhamun. And all of these things are set down into pictures, which we are now able to decode with modern technology. And the whole idea of this super science was to tell us, to illustrate that we're far, far more intelligent than we are today. We couldn't possibly achieve this with our brains today.
No, there's no way.
Absolutely no way. One only has to have a look at these pictures, and they're just mind-blowing and beautiful, and we just have to go into a different dimension when we see them, because it begs humility. It makes us feel so insignificant and inconsequential that these people, these sons of God, the original sons of God, have walked the earth many times. And in Mesoamerica, Central and South America, we refer to them as sun kings. And other people have mentioned sun kings, but their familiarity has arisen through psychic interpretation.
Why does it seem, though, Maurice, that it seems to, at a certain point in humanity, stop, or is it still ongoing and we just don't know about it, these reincarnations?
Oh, it's still ongoing, and it's all around us. And, you see, they were trying to tell us, they were saying, look, we are cleverer than you. So listen to what we're saying about the spiritual side of life, which takes us onto the second part of our discussion, really, because we've had a look at the science, and now we must balance this with the other side of the equation, which is energy or spirituality. And after all, the most important equation, mathematical equation today on Earth, was left by Albert Einstein. another very spiritually predisposed human being, even though he was a science. He loved scientist, he loved God. And he said, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared, E equals MC squared. So we've had a look at the mass, the physical world. But unfortunately, throughout the history of mankind, scientists have chosen to ignore the energy, except the massive energy that arises from the nuclear explosion when the mass of of a radioactive material like uranium is smashed together. We get an enormous explosion. In that sense, in a scientific and a physical sense, they've looked at the energy, but again, never in the spiritual way. And of course, we have to go back to the Bible, because the Bible says God is light. And we now know that light is electromagnetic energy. So in the beginning, there was God, light, electromagnetic energy, which tells us that God, energy, must have been sacrificed to create a massive explosion, the Big Bang, which brought into being the physical universe which we see around us.
Were you in shock when you began to uncover some of this?
I wouldn't say shock. When I discovered the face of Lord Peikau, the full-sized face and head in the amazing lid of Palenque, I was moved to tears because I just couldn't believe it. I'd already decoded about 60 pictures, but they were very abstract pictures, all about archaeology. And it was only when I got onto the second level of decoding, the first, I began to understand when I wrote The Amazing Lid of Palenque Part 1, that part one was simply a program. In other words, when we go to the theatre, we get a program telling us about the actors and the plot. Now, when I'd written The Amazing Lid of Palenque in 1991, I thought I'd finished. But then I stumbled upon the second level of decoding, and I realized that the part one was only the program, and that I had yet to decode the book itself, which was in a different part of the carving. Once I decoded the book, I started to see moving pictures, a theatre production that used the gods of the Mayas throughout the ages to describe the plot and the story of life, why we're here, and what heaven and hell is. That's when I became very moved by it all.
Do you believe that the Mayans were equally as advanced as the Egyptians, or vice versa?
That's a mistake I wrestled with for quite some time, but that's the same mistake as imagining that everybody in Israel was as clever as Jesus,
mm-hmm.
that everybody in Israel could walk on the water, that everybody in Israel could turn water into wine, that everybody in Israel could heal the sick with their bare hands. Of course, it wasn't like that 2,003 years ago. One man in Israel was very clever, and this is the way it is in Mexico and Peru. Lord Peikau was the brains behind the chisel in Mexico. The Viracochas were the brains behind the chisel in Peru.
All right, stay with us. Let's chat more about this, Maurice. It's just fascinating. It really is. I'll be back with more in just a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. My guest tonight, Maurice Cottrell, and we're talking about his various travels, ancient civilizations. By the way, you might want to take a look at his website. Fascinating. Several books there, Lost Tomb of Viracocha, the Tutankhamun prophecies, the Mayan prophecies. And just take a look. It's already linked up. Lex has it linked up with my website. So just look under Maurice's name under tonight's guest, and there it is for you. Maurice, we were talking about the extinction possibly, or whatever happened to the Mayans. And you were talking a little bit about the possibility, I think, that sun flares, sun storms might have had something to do with screwing up one's genetic makeup. And then we talked about the gods for a little bit. So do you think that's what diminished their population?
Yes. If we look at the sunspot signature over thousands of years, what we find is that the decline of sun-worshipping civilizations corresponds with declines in sunspot activity. Now, this results from various factors. Clearly, if the sun's radiation reduces or is disrupted from its norm, then the fertility menstrual cycle in females will be disrupted. So we'll get a global shift in fertility on Earth, a decline. Now, that'll be northern latitudes, equatorial regions, and so on, all over the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, something else happened down in Mexico to make the Mayas disappear, whereas in the northern latitudes, like the UK and North America, we didn't disappear.
We did not. That's true.
Okay. And this is because of several other effects of the solar magnetic reversals, the neutral sheet reversals on the sun. A secondary factor is that we know from dendrochronological records and tree ring data that sunspots have come and gone periodically. And we know that ice ages, mini ice ages, correspond with sunspot minimums. So when there are less when there is less magnetic activity on the sun, when we see fewer sunspots on the surface of the sun, which is a manifestation of magnetic activity, which occurs every 11 and a half years on the sun's surface, we get a mini ice age, which leads to less evaporation of the waters from the world's oceans. This means less rainfall, which of course is critical in equatorial regions, but not so bad in northern and southern latitudes. So here we are in Palenque in 750 AD, and what we find is that we have less rainfall, we have crop failures.
Uh-huh, many.
The Mayas
yeah.
have nothing to eat, so they disappear. Another effect is that when we get sunspot minimums, we get less particles emitted from the sun, less protons and electrons. And this allows more X-rays and gamma rays to escape from the sun's surface to bombard the Earth. And this causes spontaneous fetal abortion
mm-hmm.
after about 90 days. So early impregnated females lose their babies after about 90 days because of this bombardment of X-rays. Now, of course, the X-rays affect the equatorial regions, again, much more than
right.
northern and southern.
So all this is happening to them at the same time?
It is, yes. And so they have a triple whammy, basically. And so in 750 AD, there was nothing left of the Maya who predicted their own demise. They worshipped a magic number, 1366560, the birth of Venus, which begins in 3113 BC, which we talked about earlier. And they predicted that 1,366,560 days after their calendar began, they would disappear, and they did in 750 AD.
Right to the button. Now, I also want to ask you about, because we've gotten different interpretations about what the Mayan calendar end date means, 2012. In your opinion, what does that all mean?
Well, the books of Chile and Balam of Chumayel, which was written in the 16th century, quote a date of 2012 for the end of civilization as we know it. And the reason they quote that date is because there is a statement which says that in the year Catan 13, Ahu, and Ahu is Sunday or God's Day, then the men will be without children, in other words, infertility, and there will be no bread, there will be a famine. And at the same time, the earth will not see the sun for 5 days, the sun will be eclipsed. Now, that seems to suggest that a magnetic reversal is coming in the year 2012, which would account for famine, as we saw in the Maya in 750 AD, and infertility through a disruption in the fertility cycle. And, of course, if the Earth tilts on its axis, then we wouldn't be able to see the sun because of all the debris caused by tidal waves, volcanic eruptions, and so on. Now, there is some ambiguity in the date. And very often people say, do I believe the world will end in 2012? Well, the answer to that is yes and no. The reason being, because the Mayas were cleverer than us, and therefore we should listen to what they've got to say.
All right, what did they tell us with us, yes or no?
They said it would, well, we have to look at the statement now, Catan 13 Ahu. In other words, the world will end after Catan, which is a period of 7,200 days. And 13 Ahu, 13 days, 13 months, if you like, and Ahu is the 20th day in the 20-day cycle. Multiplying these three periods, and this is what observers or commentators have done, they've put 7,200, Catan, multiplied by 13, multiplied by 20, which is a period of 5,012 years. Now, if we take that back to the start date of the Mayan calendar, when I say 5,000, I think it's 5,112. I don't have my my calculator at hand. It's 5,125 years from 3113 BC. What this means is that the world will end in 2012.
Now, what do you mean by end? Just boom, it's done?
Well, yes, it could tilt on its axis, but my calculations don't show a magnetic flip occurring at that time. In fact, if you work out the figures, then the next magnetic flip should arrive 3,740 years after the date the Mayas disappeared, which will be A.D. 4,360. So it's not for another 2,300 years or so.
Okay, so we don't have to worry about that according to these calculations, but something's going to happen on 2012.
That's what they say. However, there is some ambiguity in the date because the expression Catan 13 Ahu might refer to the 20th day Ahu, but on Catan 13. In other words, the calculation thus becomes 7,200 multiplied by 13 only, which is not 260, which means that the Catan 13 Ahu would appear every 256 years and not 3,740 years. Now, of course, enquirers have discounted this figure because the world does not end every 256 years.
No, not at all.
So, you know, which is right? It would seem that we could discount the 256-year period, which leaves us with a 5,125-year period, which ends in 2012. And just because my magnetic calculations don't show a correlation, it doesn't mean the end won't come. There could be another mechanism which we don't quite understand. And one I favor, for example, I refer to as magnetic hysteresis, or delay. And what this means is that when the sun's magnetic field flipped in 750 AD, the Earth's magnetic field and the sun's magnetic field were pointing in different directions, like two compass needles pointing in different directions.
Opposites.
And what would happen in a situation like this is the bigger needle, the sun, would try to swing the little needle back into the same orientation. This would put a stress on the Earth.
Almost tear it apart.
Well, what would happen is the rotating core in the Earth would tend to skew over a long period until the two of them realign again. And when it does tend to realign, again, the magnetic reversal, the polar flip, might actually come 1,000 years after it began and not at the time it began. And what would happen is that the inner core of the Earth would start to heat up after 750 AD, and that would cause more volcanic activity and greater eruptions. And this might, for example, in 2012, lead to the blowing of the supervolcanoes, for example, like the one in Yellowstone National Park, which is due to go off, scientists or geologists say, around that time. Now, what that would mean is that if the volcanoes start to go off, then we could have ash scattered all over the face of the Earth.
Right, which would give us that that clouded effect, which would kill off greenery and then eventually life.
Yes, we'd have a global nuclear winter would set in, a global winter would set in because of volcanic ash in the atmosphere. That's exactly right. And we might not, of course, see the sun for 5 days. It might be eclipsed because of the ash.
Are we going to see signs before that date in December 2012? Or is it just going to just happen like that?
Without empirical data of the last time it occurred, which was 5,125 years ago, it's difficult to say. We are told that Venus flipped on that occasion instantly. Now, some scientists disregard all of this because they say, well, look, if the Earth flips on its axis, then we would expect the polar caps to melt as they reposition themselves on the equator, and we would expect new poles to reestablish themselves, which isn't the case because ice core samples go back millions of years, which means that the ice caps have stayed in their position in space for millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems that Emanuel Velikovsky addressed a similar problem to this when he tried to explain polar reversals on Earth, polar flips. And he suggested that when he was inquiring into the cause of ice ages, which is slightly different, he was trying to figure out what causes an ice age because it didn't make sense to him. For example, it's not cold, it's not caused by colder temperatures. If we have colder temperatures, we have less evaporation of water, which means less rain, less snow globally. And that would mean that the polar caps could not grow. When temperatures get warmer, we have more evaporation of water from the oceans. But clearly, the warmer temperatures would make the polar caps melt. So nobody really understands what makes the polar caps grow periodically and then retract again, this cyclical growing and retardation of the polar caps. Velikovsky suggested that the only way the polar caps could grow is if the core of the Earth became hot and the oceans boiled from below. That way we'd get more precipitation. The precipitation would condense in the colder atmosphere and the polar caps would grow. And this, excuse me,
yeah.
This gives us the an insight into what might be happening, because it would seem that when the magnetic reversal flips and the Earth's core starts to increase in temperature, then as Velikovsky predicted, the skin of the Earth would get hotter, the oceans would start to get warmer, but also what we would notice is that the polar caps would melt, but only from the underneath where they touch the Earth. Would become slushy. So when the polar tilt happens, the Earth tilts on its axis, but leaves the poles in their position in space, which they were already at.
See, we're only 9.5 years away from this.
That's correct.
Actually, let's see, 9.5, let's make, no, we're 8.5 years.
Yes.
That's it, 8.5 years from now.
If it happens.
If it happens. What do you think? What's your gut tell you here?
Well, it's not my gut, it's my head tells me that the Mayans were cleverer than we are, and therefore we should listen to what they were saying. And it seems that they could well have had some information which we don't possess at this time, which wouldn't be at all surprising, given that we've only just embraced the sunspot cycles, the solar wind, and all the other endocrinological effects that the sun has on living organisms. So there's a good chance that if they say it's going to happen and the interpretation of that date is correct, then life may end in 2012 as the Earth flips on its axis.
That's kind of frightening to think, Maurice. And there's nothing we can do about it, is there?
It's only frightening if you're concerned with the spiritual aspects of life. Sorry, the physical aspects.
The physical.
Yes. If you're concerned about the spiritual aspects, you realize that we are spiritual beings by nature, and that we're entombed in a body for 70 years. So we're released from the body at that time, and we will, so the decoded messages tell us, we will reincarnate again on Earth. So it's only a pause, if you like. We will come back again.
Well, the visitations that the Mayans witnessed, do you believe that they were godlike or physical?
The evidence suggests that they were like us, they were spiritual beings by nature, and that they were the sons of God. And in fact, in the Bible, Jesus tells us about men, he says, you are gods. You know, that the electromagnetic energy that holds the atoms together, that drives electrical currents around the body, that drops electrical voltages across the brain cells, is electromagnetic energy, the same phenomenon as we are told God is. The Bible tells us God is light. Now, the ancients believed that we had four separate bodies existing in separate dimensions, and that those dimensions subscribed to different rules. For example, we have the physical body, the emotional body, the intellectual body, and the astral or soul energy body.
Yes.
Now, in the physical world, we can have a look at how these mechanisms differ in the physical world. If I have a dollar and you have a dollar and we exchange them, we both finish up with a dollar, which seems to suggest that we can't get something for nothing in the physical world. But the intellectual world isn't like that. If I have an idea and you have an idea and we exchange them, then we both finish up with two ideas, which suggests that, at least in the intellectual dimension, if we can double our intellectual wealth at no cost. Taking that one step further, in the emotional world, if I love you, it seems that my voltage, my soul voltage, will increase. But if I hate you, my soul voltage will diminish and get less.
Well, there's no question that negativity, I think, breeds negative energy.
Absolutely. And what the scriptures tell us and what the decoded pictures of the ancient sun-worshipping civilizations tell us is that if we love other people, then our soul voltage will grow to such a level that we'll radiate light from the head, we'll acquire a halo, and that on physical death, the soul will be repatriated with God in heaven. Whereas if our physical battery, the soul voltage, has gone down because we've lived a bad life, then it will come back to earth again. Now, all of the scriptures believe in reincarnation, and some people argue, well, that's not the case. For example, Christianity believes that we have a body and soul, yes. But if we're good, the body goes to heaven, yes. But if we're bad, the soul goes to hell. But what we're told is, looking at Einstein's equation, is this physical earth must be hell. Because in the beginning, if E equals MC squared, and God sacrificed some of his energy and transformed it into mass, then as it goes across the equation, that energy must change its sign. Mm-hmm. In other words, everything in the physical world must be the opposite of God. In other words, the physical world must be hell, and everything in the physical world must be the devil. So clearly what we have here is that mankind, at a certain point in its evolution, acquired a soul from God, a piece of godly energy. So we have a piece of God attached to a piece of the devil. So mankind, on the one hand, is God, our gods, and on the other hand, mankind exists in the physical world, and the physical world, we are told in the Bible, is the beast, or 666, and we live in a carbon-based atmosphere universe, which has, and carbon has six electrons, six protons, and six neutrons.
Well, I can see how some would think that the planet Earth is hell, especially on sometimes.
Oh, it is hell. And this is why Christianity, as I say, actually does subscribe to the notion of reincarnation, because if you now put the information together, what we get is that you will either go to heaven or you will come to hell, and hell is earth. And so therefore we reconcile Christianity with all of the other religions who believe in reincarnation. Now the evidence for reincarnation is overwhelming once we start to decode the ancient treasures of the sun-worshipping kings. Whether we go to Peru or Egypt or Mexico, all of the information was encoded for us to decode at a later moment in history.
Okay, well, when we come right back, Maurice, I want to talk with you about reincarnation. Then at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phones for Maurice Cottrell. I'm George Norrie. This is Worldwide Coast to Coast AM.
I did.
Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Maurice, let's talk, if we can, for a moment about reincarnation and the Mayans' thoughts on that. What I find fascinating about this, what the Egyptians knew, is the fact that there had to have been some teachings from somewhere, from above perhaps, from another civilization that might have come down a long, long time ago. One, is that true? And two, if it is, where's the evidence for visitations from extraterrestrials in, I would assume, to be some kind of machinery or flying equipment?
The first thing is, George, I prefer not to use the expression extraterrestrials or flying machines because, you know, I don't think Jesus arrived in a spacecraft, but he was not of this earth.
Okay, so it's important for you to point that out.
It is, because I'm certainly not suggesting that men have come to Earth, as others have suggested, to teach mankind the higher knowledge. The decoded information from all of the artifacts tells us a story, and they tell us a story about reincarnation. For example, the Amazing Lid of Palenque tells us that we are both body and soul, and when the soul leaves the body, it either goes to heaven or it goes into the underworld. From the underworld, it either goes through purgatory, where the heart is purged of sin, as the heart confesses in purgatory, that's where the word comes from, and then goes on to heaven to get back to God. Or if the soul is so depleted of energy, it simply stays in the underworld for 3,740 years or thereabouts, and then comes back to earth again. Now, there are mechanisms of reincarnation, and again, the decoded artifacts, the stories tell us that there is an inverse transmigration principle, and what that means is that fat people come back as thin people come back as fat people, or as the Bible says...
And it just flip-flops all the time.
It does. The first will be last, and the last will be first.
If you're good, you come back bad. If you're bad, you come back good. And I'm not saying, obviously, if you reach perfection and got to heaven, you don't come back.
Oh, no, that's true. You don't come back. You become one with God again.
Right.
It's only if you're bad that you come back to earth and for another try at purification. And, in fact, it's so difficult to escape this hell that the super teachers have been here to tell us how to do it. But it's very complex because God created a perfect mechanism, and what we see is that when good souls go back to God, God grows in voltage. Now, this seems to be the case because, again, if we look at the Bible, God said that he made man in his own image, and it seems that because God is good and God is love, the only thing better than God must be more God, that God would want to grow. But again, it seems that because he made man in his own image, it suggests that man cannot grow, and therefore God cannot grow. When I say that, what I mean is man can only grow if he sacrifices some chromosomes, a sperm. A female can only grow beyond a certain limit if she sacrifices some chromosomes in an egg. Indeed, the only known mechanism in the physical world is through sacrifice, growth through sacrifice. An apple tree can only grow if it throws an apple away. So it seems that in the beginning, God wanted to grow because it's good, but he couldn't grow. There seems to be something limiting about God which inhibits spontaneous unilateral growth. So God created the physical universe and created mankind, or I should say that the universe created mankind through the process of evolution and time. Because in the beginning, when there was light, nothing happened. But as soon as the physical world was created, then we had time, we had day and night, we had rain, we had wind, and so on, and we had evolution. And what happens is that the chemicals came together and created a single cell creature like the amoeba, and through time and evolution, the single cell creature became more and more complex to such an extent that we became primates, and the voltage across the brain reached a certain level, a certain voltage, which was opposite that of God, because it went across the equation, as I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And that voltage across the brain during a time in our evolutionary period sucks down another bubble of godly energy. So in other words, if the physical voltage was of the brain was, for example, -5 volts, that sucked down +5 volts from God. So we became human beings in the womb with a body and a soul, not just a body.
But there must have been a master plan for this to occur throughout the entire planet, maybe different time periods, as we talked about earlier, but without a doubt, it was widespread. It was in South America. It was in Mexico. It was in Egypt. It was in Asia. It was like there was a plan here.
Yes, I call the plan the theory of divine reconciliation, and it reconciles why we're here and what God was up to. And in creating bodies on Earth that could purify themselves through sacrifice. This is what the Bible teaches us, that we purify our heart through suffering and our voltage grows and then we go to heaven. So here we have a mechanism which allows God to grow, because when we go back to God, he becomes a much larger voltage. So we have a physical world and a spiritual world. And the physical world is very difficult to escape because it's hell. As Dante said in his Inferno, abandon hope, all ye who enter. Now, it has to be secret, because if everybody loved each other, then everybody would go to heaven. And that means there'd be nobody left behind to have babies, nobody left behind to bring souls down from heaven, and God would stop growing. So only a certain number of souls can leave the earth at any given time. And in the Bible, the book of Revelation tells us that it's 144,000 souls. Now, I don't think we should take that literally, because
a lot of people have taken that number literally, though. You're right.
They have. And what I refer to is Bruce Cathy's calculation for the speed of light. Now, Bruce Cathy is a New Zealand researcher, and he recalculated the figure used by Einstein. Einstein used a figure of 300 times 10 to the 6 meters per second, the speed of light across two different points. Now, Bruce Cathy found that this was just not usable when we were looking at the surface of light around a sphere, around the globular Earth, for example. And he used different equations to show that the speed of light around a sphere was 144,000 minutes of arc per second. Now, here we have a relationship, therefore, between the number mentioned in Revelation and the manifestation of light.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that what the ancients were trying to tell us in the Bible was that once we can generate light from the head, a halo, then we'll go to heaven. And if we look at the speed of light around the Earth, 144,000 minutes of arc per second, divided by 60 minutes of arc in a degree, divided by 360 degrees in a circle, we realize that 6.66 revolutions of the Earth is achieved by a light beam in 1 second.
Well, let me ask you this, Maurice. Of course, under biblical terms, they talk about the beginning, the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. Some think the Garden of Eden was in Iraq. In South American writings or Mexican writings, do they talk about a Garden of Eden there as well?
We only talk about the Garden of Eden in the last 5,012-year period. That's when we, as far as some subscribe to the view that Noah's Ark goes back to the last time, the last deluge, when the earth was covered in water. And we look at the age of the earth, 4 billion years, and it begins to become clear that we've been here for billions of years, that we keep coming back over and over and over again every few thousand years in these 5,012-year cycles, if you like. It's just that we can't remember being here before. Now, again, the treasures from the tombs tell us as much. If we go to the tomb of Tutankhamun, we find that he preserved the organs of the body except the heart and the brain. And this was a way of telling us that when we come back again, we'll have a new brain with a new memory and a new heart with new feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a mechanism of reincarnation which prevents us learning from one life to the next. It makes it much more difficult to escape hell, because if every time we remember this knowledge, then we'd get cleverer and cleverer with every incarnation.
We're supposed to be, yeah.
And that defeats the rules. That defeats the rules of the game of reincarnation, if you like, where there's no escape. It's very, very, very difficult to escape hell. And the only way, therefore, we can increase our knowledge of this stuff is to write it down in one incarnation. It's become, first of all, become aware of it like we are now. And let's say that, for example, we're 69 years old today. I happen to be 51. But let's say we were 69 years old, and suddenly we realized that all this information was available, all this knowledge was available, and that if we purify our spirit, we can go to heaven. But of course, we only live for 70 years, so we've only got 1 year left. So it's impossible during the next year to purify our spirit. And of course, it becomes more possible the younger we are when we become aware of the information. Now, clearly, if we were to encode it, if we were to realize that we're not going to learn it and we're going to lose it, and it could take thousands of years to get this technology back again once the world's been destroyed, it makes sense to encode the information into our treasures under large geographically obvious monuments like pyramids that we can see. People look at a pyramid and start asking questions. What is it? What is it doing there? Who built it? And so on. So this is why many of the civilizations built these large structures.
Why the similarities, though? In China, South America, Egypt, they're all over the country, they're all over the planet, and they're all similar.
Well, I mean, don't forget we're talking about sun worship, and the sun is the most important body in our world, in our solar system, in our existence.
Mm-hmm.
And in a simple sense, if we look at the sun's rays coming down, they describe a pyramid shape as they strike the earth, a triangle on earth, if you like. And a pyramid comes from pyrotechnic, or funeral pyre, which is a fire. And a pyramid represents the fire in the sky, the sun, if you like, on earth. So because all of this information, all of these civilizations worship the sun, we find the same use of the indicators throughout the civilizations, even though there are thousands of years apart and on geographically different continents.
I haven't heard you mention, and I'm going to pronounce the name, I'll get close to it, Quetzalcoatl?
Quetzalcoatl, yes. Now,
was he
Lord Peikau.
Oh, okay, okay. So that's one and the same.
It's one and the same. He was the feathered snake, and the feathers epitomize the eagle or the spirit in the sky, and the snake, the body on the ground that shed its skin periodically. So here we're told that the spirit in the sky came down to earth, just like Jesus, to inhabit a body, to incarnate. And Lord Peikau, therefore, was the perfect being on earth.
Why create a different name?
It's not really a different name. What we find is that Tutankhamun was also the feathered snake. He carried the vulture and the snake on his forehead.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
We also learn that the Viracochas were feathered snakes from the treasures in their tomb. And it's on the one hand, it's a metaphor in its simple sense for the perfect being. But as we start to inquire into the super science of the civilizations, we'll realize that the feathered snake, this wavy motion that looks like a snake with feathers, is actually a representation of the sun's magnetic fields in a super scientific sense. And I was put onto this by some ancient tablets which came from Tibet, discovered in 1906 by the explorer James Churchwood, who was working as a secret agent for the British Army in Brahmaputra, Tibet. And he visited a monastery there during his stay, and the monks told him, or showed him, some ancient tablets which explained the sinking of the lost continent of Lemuria, or Mu, in the Pacific, which legend has it sank to the sea 25,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
with a loss of 64 million people. And Churchwood sketched the sun, and he explained how the sun's radiation increased the temperature of the landmass Lemuria. The gases bubbled out of the rocks, and the landmass sank beneath the waves of the Pacific. And on the sketches that Churchwood drew, he drew pictures of the sun from the Tibetan records. And one of the pictures of the sun showed across the equator a feathered snake, which resembles the neutral warp of the sun's magnetic field and the 11-year sunspot cycle superimposed on top of it.
Incredible.
So it seems there are two interpretations of this feathered snake, Quetzalcoatl, adopted by the Peruvians, the Egyptians, and the Mayans.
When does modern science ever look at some of these episodes and use that as a guide to what the future could hold? How come they just don't seem to realize it?
It seems that, you see, some souls are very young souls, and other souls, like yours and mine, are very, very old. I say yours, George, because you're here today. You're part of this. We're all coming together again.
Sure. The mere fact that I even show an interest, or anybody else, in this topic, I think, shows some kind of evolution.
Exactly. And the Tibetans refer to this as sanskaras, whereby souls can carry modulations, although they don't carry memory and emotional or intellectual value in that memory. They can carry sanskaras. And this is, it's like information, even though it's the same. Now, I can describe this as follows. If we take a 1 pound lump of dough, 16 ounces of dough, and we knead the bread before we bake it, we can make the loaf into a circle or a letter O, or we could make it into a letter C, or we could make it into a letter T. We could give the dough a different shape before we put it in the oven. Now, when we take the bread out, the bread is the same bread, it's the same ingredients, it's the same taste, it's the same temperature, it's the same weight, but it carries information, the different letters of the alphabet. Now, in the same way, the soul carries these sanskaras. The bubble of soul energy, if you like, finishes up like a golf ball with little nodules on it, or with like little pyramids on it. It carries information from one life into the next. This is why we get child prodigies like Mozart, who come back as musicians, because the sanskaras have been carried over from one previous life to the next. Something's happened in the reincarnation process, which has allowed more sanskaras. This could be a factor of time. In other words, he was a very, very old soul, and the accumulation of the sanskaras are such that they accommodate the prodigy element. That isn't clear yet, but what is clear is that the soul has some individuals are drawn to this knowledge because it's time to be drawn to it, but others, you can show them the pictures and they can't even see the pictures. They're blinded by it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like trying to describe a sunset to a blind man. They insist there is no sunset there because they can't see it. Now, other people can instantly see them and they say, you know, that they're overwhelmed and so on. In the Bible, it says that God made some men blind so that they could not see. He ensured that the teachings were secret, that they were in parables, riddles, that they were in pictures. And indeed, the ancients encoded their information using pictures or numbers because they knew that once they died in this life, they might not come back for 3,000 years or so, by which time they may not be speaking the same language. For example, the Spaniards may have invaded their country because it does seem that souls come back to the same DNA. That's why I mentioned the same country. This is why the Inca kings married their sisters, so that if they didn't go to heaven, they'd come back in the same family, the same DNA.
Hmm.
This is why the Egyptian kings married their sisters, so that if they didn't get to heaven, they'd come back as a king again for another chance. This is why they encoded the information into their pyramids and their treasures like Tutankhamun.
I'll tell you what, I love my sisters, Maurice, but I don't think I'd want to marry them. Uh-uh. No siree. Not at all. Hey, we're going to come right back, and when we do, I want to talk with you a little bit more about this. And again, I want to hone in on that 2012 date. It's only 8.5 years away. That's pretty darn fast. It's coming up real quickly, isn't it?
It is.
And we'll take phone calls, too. We'll open up the phone lines, give you a chance to chat with Maurice Cottrell. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
They buried me in that great tomb that knows no sound, but I'm still around. I'll always be around, and around, and around, and around, and around. I fly a starship across the universe divide, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again, or I may simply be a single drop of rain, but I will remain, and I'll be back again and again and again.
Maurice, Saddam Hussein, I want to ask you this, just to get your thoughts on it, believes that he is the reincarnated version of King Nebuchadnezzar. What possesses someone to think that he might be that person?
It's difficult to say, George. We come across this all the time where it's very often a well-known figure of history, as in this case. Perhaps they really do feel it. Perhaps they are the reincarnation. There are several explanations, or perhaps they're just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a little bit of everything here.
Yeah.
I think that some of the accounts must be correct. It's a bit like crop circles. Some of them must be fakes, and some of them must be delusion. So I wouldn't like to comment on him in particular. If he is the reincarnation, he's not doing a very good job in this reincarnation. And it's difficult to say, isn't it?
Okay, let's go to some calls. We'll continue chatting with Maurice Cottrell. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, it's Valerie from Philadelphia on WPHT.
Hi, Valerie.
Hi, I have two questions and a comment for Maurice. I just want to let you know I love all your hard work. It's greatly appreciated. The question is, if the radiation from the sun, was it sunspots or solar flares? I'm not sure. Which causes it, makes female women start to become infertile. Would it also affect the female animal population? And the other question is, why doesn't, when the poles shift, why don't we just grow a new North Pole at the new location and the old one melt?
Yes, thank you, Valerie. A couple of questions there. The first one about solar flares and sunspots. I'm sorry, my mind was elsewhere for a second. They do affect fertility on Earth, yes. I'm sorry, Valerie.
And the other one was with the pole shifts. I mean, why can't, she was saying grow back another pole shift, but why can't they shift back quicker?
The poles do reestablish themselves, the magnetic poles, once the Earth is tilted. And this is, we know this from magnetic records and rocks. So once the Earth has slipped on its axis, the magnetic field of the Earth will slide around and reestablish itself between the poles.
Now, when illustrate for us, if you can, Maurice, by sort of painting a picture for us. As the poles are shifting, what are we seeing if one were just looking at this in slow motion? What does it look like?
Well, if we look at Velikovsky's accounts again, Velikovsky questioned why we could get palm tree fossils in Spitsbergen in the Arctic Circle, where there is no daylight for much of the year, why we could get oil deposits in the Antarctic, where no organic life or very little organic life lives, and why frozen mammoths were found on the spot in Siberia with buttercups clenched between their teeth. And Velikovsky came to the conclusion that the Earth must have tilted on its axis several times during the history of the planet, and these polar shifts must have occurred very, very quickly, instantaneously, if you like. There were one or two questions left unanswered, which I hope I answered earlier, about how can the polar caps be so old if they, you know, and it's because they keep their position in space as the Earth tilts below. But going back to Valerie's question now, I've just sidetracked for a second. Throughout history, there have been magnetic reversals. We know them. They're well documented. And scientists do believe that species do decline when we have magnetic reversals on Earth. So they seem to be synonymous, magnetic reversal, decline in certain species. As for what we see when the pole tilts, well, you'd probably see a tidal wave about 100 miles high. We'd have earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. And this is why we've got fossils of thousands of animals piled up together that Velikovsky mentions again, because the tidal waves swept across continents and swept all the living animals to one place where they then become lost in the mud in the over time and fossilized. So I would think it's pretty horrendous to experience such an event.
Maurice, as we look toward 2012, I mean, does this seem to be, in your opinion, the most pressing time that's coming up to us now? Some would call it end times. Or are we going to have some problems along the line here?
Again, it's difficult to say without this missing link of what made the Mayas suggest that 2012 was going to be the end date.
Right.
Given our present scientific understanding, there is no evidence that that's going to be the case. But then again, as I said earlier, because they were much cleverer than we are.
Science has been wrong.
Exactly. Then we need to listen to what they've been telling us.
Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with my guest, Maurice Cottrell. Hi there.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
This is Mike in Lancaster.
Uh-huh.
And, George, I called you about a couple of weeks ago. And, Maurice, hello.
Hi there.
I'm very happy to be able to ask you my question. I'd like to ask you and then tell you why specifically I'd like to know about it. It's with all that is going on now with 2012, thinking of galactic alignment and, you know, all that the cultures also have to demonstrate, as John Major Jenkins shows in some of his writing that's going to be coming out, that they knew of the center of the galaxy. Have you thought of, you know, correlating that with your large body of evidence, because you have so much, especially that the idea that when the, you know, the warp in the sun's you know, neutral warp flips, that that may affect, you know, the tilting, you know, of the planets. It seems like that's something that may happen on a precessional basis, possibly even the, you know, the Mayan precessional number of years that I think you mentioned in your book of 25,000, you know, 627. Have you thought of that?
Oh, yes, Mike, I have. Yes, thanks for the question. I have thought about it at great length, and I'm a little bit disturbed by it insofar as because there might be a galactic cyclical movement,
right.
And the galaxy may have a line of meridian, like an equator. It doesn't necessarily mean that a physical phenomenon results from crossing that conceptual line of meridian. For example, when a ship sails across the equator, it doesn't smash into the line.
Right.
Nothing happens. So I have an intellectual problem in coming to terms with the fact that because we may or may not be passing through a center line of the galaxy, that it will have any effect whatsoever.
Well, can I tell you why I asked that then? And maybe I'm sure you've already read Paul LaViolette's book, Earth, Thunder, Fire, and the idea of, you know, the ciphered galaxies exploding periodically. The reason why that's so interesting to me right now is that I've been looking more at this 28-degree angle of variance that you have at Giza, say, from the Hudson Bay Pole. I mentioned to George a couple of weeks ago how that's also encoded in the pyramid and the difference between the King and Queen's Chamber on the central axis. I've also noticed that the Hopi, you know, figure into that as well. I don't know if you've ever seen the Fire Clan tablet or what's called sometimes the Pathway Stone. Have you seen that of the Hopis?
I can't say I have, Mike, but I would like to mention that the 28-day figure appears over and over again in ancient treasures because we have a 28-day solar cycle against the sun, which results in fertility. And it wouldn't surprise me if it were to be encoded in degree fashion in the treasures of the Egyptians.
You know, Maurice, when you say it wouldn't surprise you, it is strange in one way that there are a lot of cultural similarities with what you say, I don't know how they all knew about these things in their own respective times, other than the tie-in being the god figures.
Exactly. And as I say, they use the numbers because numbers transcend language barriers. So if we are to experience a pole tilt, and if we are all reduced to chimpanzees again, sooner or later we evolve into these higher level primates with high intellects, and we will always get up onto our feet and once again count on our 10 fingers. So numbers were a common denominator that transcended civilizations. So in the Bible, we find certain numbers are used to convey information. And the Bible in Revelation says, "He who has wisdom, let him count the number." And it says this about 8 times in Revelation. So numbers are very important. And what we find in the Bible is we have 666. Also, we have the corollary of that, which 666 is a mark of the beast, 999 is the opposite, which is a mark of God. And this was used by all the super gods. We find that 999 appears in all of the tombs. And also the rotational rates of the sun's magnetic fields appear, 26 and 28 for the equatorial magnetic cycle of the sun, and 37 for the polar magnetic cycle of the sun. So by using astronomical constants in the sky, we can describe how the sun affects life on Earth, and thereby revisit, refrequent this ancient knowledge, and from doing that, learn the ancient knowledge as I've set down in these books. So it's not the first time we've been here, but it's the first time for a few thousand years that we've been here.
Of the books that we've been talking about, do you have a specific favorite, or do you like them all?
Well, each book led on to another, so I always say that you can always tell a good discovery because it leads on to another one. And each of these books led on to another one. Once I'd done the Mayan prophecies, it occurred to me, just like you, it raises the question of who brought this knowledge, where did it come from? Then I realized that it was one person and not the entire Mayas who were aware of the knowledge. Once I started to think about that, I started to ask the questions of how come the same knowledge keeps coming throughout history from various religions. And then it appeared, or it became apparent, that they had to be the same guy. But given that there were different bones in different pyramids, it could not be the same guy, which only left one explanation. It has to be the same spiritual energy who keeps coming back. And, of course, this spiritual energy doesn't need boats to cross the ocean. It doesn't need aircraft or anything like that. You know, the spiritual world has no boundaries. It has no time constraints and so on. And this is why the knowledge appears spontaneously on different continents. Nobody took a boat ride from Egypt to Maya land. It's a different appearance of a super teacher over time. It's an indicator that one of these super gods, sons of gods, has been to Earth. And it to teach us about life, the truth about life, the truth about the soul, the truth about the body, the limitations of both.
The ride might have been in the spiritual ocean. That's probably the ride they took. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes,
sir.
My
name is Jake. I am east of the Rockies in St. Albans, Vermont, listening to 96.7 The Zone.
Oh, great. Welcome to the program, Jake.
First time caller, very, very long time listener.
Good for you.
My question for Maurice is about the number 144,000 that you were talking about earlier.
Yes.
I was in my truck listening, and I just wanted to know what was the relation to that with the Mayan civilization, the prophecies that you were talking about? And because I heard you also refer to revelations.
Yeah, very good question, Jake, very good question. In the book of Revelation, it says that those with 144,000 written on their foreheads would be the ones going to heaven.
The chosen ones, huh?
The chosen ones. And it's interesting, the expression, written on their foreheads. And when I decoded the amazing lid of Palenque, there is one particular picture which shows the head of Lord Paykal and the face. Now, we know it's the head and face because there was also a stucco plaster cast of the head on the floor of the tomb, and they're identical, so they give us a clue. Now, on the decoded picture, not only do we have the head and face of Lord Paykal, but on his forehead we have the number 144,000, 144,000. And we have the same thing in Tutankhamun's tomb, 144,000 encoded. So we see that the same numbers were used by the same civilizations to explain the same phenomenon of spiritual redemption.
Oh, wow. I found it very interesting because I'm studying Revelations right now.
Yeah.
And for Revelation 7:4, it was the 144,000 from the 12 tribes of Israel.
Yes.
12,000 from each tribe, which I thought was the 144,000 to preach the gospel. I wasn't sure about what. It was the ones that died to go, that were sealed to go to heaven, or if it was the ones to stay on earth.
It appears to be the ones. If we go back to Revelation, it says, "I saw an angel coming from the four corners of the world, and I saw another angel in the middle, if you like, saying, 'Do not hurt the sand, the trees, or the sea, until I have sealed those with the number of the living God in their foreheads.'" And what that expression seems to mean is that once the world has been destroyed, they won't be affected. In other words, they will be saved. And it's interesting because if we look at the same thing occurs, as I said, in Tut's tomb, also we find that in the book of Revelation, the last paragraph, or the second to the last paragraph, Jesus says, I, Jesus, am the root of David and the bright and morning star. Now, if you look at the paragraph that follows on, St. John says, not one word must be changed in this book of Revelation, not one word. So if we take that literally, I, Jesus, am the bright and morning star, he must mean he is the star Venus. Of course, Venus is a planet.
And the morning star.
It's the morning star, yeah, and the evening star. So it's the bright star in the evening, and it's the morning star, it's a bright star in the morning. And what we also realize, looking at the decoded stories from the Amazing Lid of Palenque, is that Lord Paykal was also Venus. He went to Venus when he died. If you look at Tutankhamun's tomb, we see a picture of him on the wall. In one scene, he's embracing Nut, goddess of the night sky. In the next, he appears as two twins, or a pair of twins, embracing Osiris in the heavens. In other words, Tutankhamun becomes Venus in the heavens. So this notion of these super teachers all sharing things in common extends even to Venus. And of course, they were trying to tell us two things. By the Mayans, by monitoring the revolutions of Venus in the Dresden Codex, they come up with a magnetic solar reversal period of 1,366,560 days, which they call the birth of Venus.
Go ahead, Maurice, let me ask you one quick thing. Who do you think might have been the more spiritual, the Egyptians or the Mayans?
Well, it's all the same guy, so I would say they're all exactly the same.
Yeah,
the
okay, good answer.
They're all exactly the same. But what we're told is Venus is the brightest and purest source of light in the heavens, and it also represents love. So they were using the observations of Venus to tell us two things. One, that purity is important and light is important, and once we become pure and light, we can go to heaven. We can become a star in the heavens. And indeed, that all the stars are actually souls, very, very ancient souls. And the stars give birth to their own planets in time. And the planets, through evolution, allow the growth of organic life. That organic life increases in voltage. And just like in our own solar system, those stars can grow and grow until they become, you know, a massive star that becomes a black hole and so on. And it goes on to the next stage of evolutionary growth. So the stars in the sky appear to be very, very ancient souls. And we can become a soul in the sky. And the ancients tell us how to do this by purifying the soul. The soul voltage comes from suffering, and suffering brings purification.
Stay with us. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norman. Back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with my guest, Maurice Cottrell. Maurice, of everything that you investigated, was there one thing that just really boggled your mind or excited your ability to do what you did when you investigated these ancient civilizations, or was it a combination of all of it?
I'd have to say it was all of it, George. It's just so overwhelming, and it goes on and on. It's like pulling a thread on a sweater. And finishing it with balls.
Yeah, I've done that. Yeah, you pull it, and by that time you have no sweater.
That's correct. And just talking, thinking of our last caller there, I'm reminded of another expression from Revelation, which ties up with the lost tomb of Viracocha. I think it's chapter 10. And it says, I saw an angel come down from heaven, and on his head was a rainbow, and across his face, as it were, the sun. And he had one foot on the land and one foot in the sea, which, of course, must be Viracocha. And if we look at the reconstruction of Viracocha Pachacamac from the museum at Lima, Viracocha Pachacamac from the attire found in his tomb is wearing a headdress which is red, blue, green and white, a rainbow, and across his mouth he's got a sun golden disc that, emulating the bat god worshipped also by the Maya. So here we have again another expression in Revelation which sounds quite extraordinary in isolation, but once we put some meaning to it, it looks like the angel that came down from heaven with the rainbow on his head and the sun across his face with one foot on the sand and one foot in the sea must have been Viracocha, foam of the sea. And of course in the tomb at Saipan we have a 2 foot high a golden figure of a crab with a man's face. So clearly the crab is a creature that lives on the sea and the land. So again, the tomb has to belong to Viracocha.
Okay, let's go to some more calls with my guest, Maurice. Let's go to first-time caller. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Hello, Maurice. Thank you very much for the conversation this evening. I'm really enjoying it.
You're welcome.
Gentlemen, for the last 2 days, I've been so psychically active that I feel like I've been processing a lot of data. It started last night when I was struggling in my sleep, only to wake up this morning and really feel like I was fighting for my soul last evening. But my question is to you, Maurice, what recommendations do you have for us based on your Mayan knowledge to assist us during these transmutations?
How to get to heaven?
Exactly.
You have to love. Jesus tells us that we have to love to purify the heart. That will increase the heart's voltage and we'll go to heaven. Now, it's easier said than done. It's easier to tell people to love each other because, after all, if the body is the devil and the soul is God, then you are surrounded by living beings which are half devil, half God. So it's not surprisingly that we're tested daily and by the minute. If we look at the Bhagavad Gita, the Indian holy book, which comes from the epic poem, the Mahabharata, from the Upanishads, some say that go back 16,000 years again, then we find that Lord Krishna, who was the incarnation of Vishnu, tells us how to love our neighbor. Now, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva were the Indian Holy Trinity, God, if you like. Vishnu came back in his eighth incarnation as Krishna, or Christ, and as I said earlier, as Buddha in the ninth incarnation. And it's a fascinating story. It's a very tiny book, actually, a tiny part of the poem. It's only about 100 pages long, although very often the books you see in bookstores have a commentary along with them, which makes the book much thicker. Now, I suggest you'll have to read the book 10 or 20 times to begin to understand the subtleties in the book. It's a wonderful story. It's all about Arjuna, the soldier, the young 19-year-old soldier, and he's on the battlefield at Kurukshetra, which is a holy place. And far away, there is the king, Dhritarashtra, and his sons are fighting against Arjuna on the battlefield, and he wants to know how the battle is going. So he asks his clairvoyant servant, Anjaya, to describe the events. And the clairvoyant is talking to the king, and this is how the Bhagavad Gita begins. The armies are fighting each other, and Arjuna is very upset because he can see the army on the other side of the valley. And some of them were his old school teachers and his old friends, and he doesn't want to kill them. And his bow slips from his hand as he stands in his chariot, and he becomes very despondent and sad. And he looks towards heaven and said, God, why have you put me on this battlefield today? I don't want to kill anybody. And then Krishna comes down from heaven and sits down next to Arjuna and explains to him why he's on the battlefield on that day. And as he explains to Arjuna, he explains the meaning of life about the soul and the body and the difference between the soul and the body and of the importance of duty and the importance of honesty. He explains the hierarchy of ethics. For example, he tells us that duty is more important than honesty, and that honesty must be subservient to duty. So we must always do our duty first and foremost. So Arjuna, in this incarnation, has been born as a soldier. Krishna tells him he has to go out and do his duty and kill. If he wins the battle, he'll be king of India. If he loses, because he has done his duty, he'll go to heaven and enjoy the kingdom of heaven. So it's not how we fight the battle. So it's not how we win or lose the battle. It is how we fight the battle. It's how the game is played, which determines the outcome of the destination of our soul.
And although, Maurice, it's thinking of duty, which I think has some Islamic fundamentalists doing what they've been doing.
Well, very often people misinterpret the scriptures. For example, the Mayans try to tell us about the effect of the sun on fertility and menstruation. So they show carvings of women kneeling in a sexually provocative position next to a man, pulling a rope with thorns through their mouth, drawing blood.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the archaeologists have interpreted this in that they were all masochists and that they liked pain. But how else do you explain that the need for blood or menstrual blood? How do you explain that the sun's radiation failed their menstrual needs? It's very difficult. But the Aztecs misinterpreted this. They started going for physical blood, ripping their hearts out of people. They lost the message over 1,000 years later that the Maya had left them. They saw these statues and thought, well, they must have known what they were talking about. Because of the monuments they built, they must have been very clever. So blood must be important, so let's sacrifice everybody and kill thousands of people. Now, the same things happened with these fanatics, certainly in the East. And they've misconstrued the message, which is a message of love. And duty comes first, as I said. And I try to illustrate the distinction. If we imagine a school teacher in a classroom who's confronted by a knife-wielding maniac who's foaming at the mouth, asking for a particular student, for example, Sally Smith, waving his knife about, does the teacher say Sally Smith has gone to the bus stop, or does she say Sally Smith is sitting on the first row of the classroom? Clearly, the teacher has a duty to protect Sally Smith, so she has to lie. She has to be dishonest and suggest the child is not there but at the bus stop, so to get rid of the maniac. So, in such a case, there is no karma, there is no fallout, there is no reaction against the lie, because her duty comes first. And once we start to read the Bhagavad Gita, we start to understand the very subtleties of life and how certain things in certain situations are acceptable and how we are tested every day and every minute by God. God tests us out every day and every minute of every day, as the Bible says. Every single hair on your head has a number. And very often we're confused by the signals we get when somebody's really cruel to us. They're actually sending us to heaven because they're making us suffer. And, of course, at the same time, they're sending themselves to hell. So when people hurt us, we should thank them. And this is why it becomes very easy to love somebody, because the more they hurt you, the more you suffer, the more your heart purifies, the greater your soul voltage becomes, and the more quickly you get to heaven.
Interesting.
It's not a bad thing when people hurt us. And it's when we get angry and want to hurt them back. We've lost the battle then. You know, every day
but it's so difficult, Maurice, not to want to fight back.
Not when you love them, it's not. You see, if you love people and you know that you're on a journey which is going in a different direction and you understand the difficulties they're experiencing, that they don't have this knowledge, that they're not ready for it, that in this lifetime, they have not been chosen as a soldier to fight the great battle, if you like.
I couldn't love in Osama bin Laden, no matter what. I just couldn't do it.
Well, clearly the guy is mentally, I think the easiest way to look at it is he's mentally ill, and therefore we've got to ask the question, where do ideas come from? Where do Osama bin Laden's ideas come from? And it seems to me that ideas come from two sources. Good ideas come from God, and bad ideas come from the body. And good ideas, if God is light, must come through the eye, the iris. And if people are listening to your radio station tonight, they have to tune into your frequency. And to do that, they tune the dial on their radio. That changes the wavelength of the antenna in the radio set. In the same way, if we are to listen to God and have the good ideas, like Einstein and Isaac Newton, those who had miraculously intelligent ideas are tuned into God. All of these men, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, they're all very spiritually aware men. They don't take the ideas that come through them as their own. And this is why pride is a sin. These good ideas don't belong to us. They come through us, through the iris, in the in the shape of light. The iris affects the pineal gland. The pineal gland affects the endocrine system. And the orchestra, the endocrine system, plays a beautiful tune inside the body. Now, when we're not tuned into God, we're not tuned into the light frequency, the endocrine system underperforms and we don't have the same intellectual capacity.
All right, let's go to some more calls. They're rolling in here, and we've only got about 5-6 minutes left. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. Yeah. This is Mike from Fontana,
sure,
California.
Sure, Michael. Go ahead, Mike.
How you doing, Maurice?
I'm fine, Mike. Thank you.
Thanks. I am studying ancient Greek physics, and one thing that I found out from Aristotle is that all is one, and I'm just trying to throw out a question. Do you think ancient Greek philosophy was, if there were sacred texts that they had gotten or knew about from ancient civilizations that knew about physics before Aristotle and Plato wrote physics that they, you know, the metaphysics and physics that they wrote 2,500 years ago. I just want to know about that.
Well, I don't know if you can answer that, Maurice, but I'll let you take a stab at it if you want to.
In a word, Mike, yes. They were aware of the superscience of the sun. I'm not quite sure who taught the early Greeks. It could have been the Celts, because the Celts were a sun-worshipping civilization in the area at the time. So it looks like there was a Celtic, in fact, I'm working on the Celtic Chronicles now. It looks like there was a Celtic sun king who walked the lands between China and Ireland from 500 BC to AD 500. So, yes, the Greeks were aware of it. The Romans seem to have been aware of it. If we look at the headdress used by the Roman centurions, it's almost identical to that used by Viracocha in the reconstructions at the Museum in Lima. So, yes, there are parallels again, and it's a fascinating area.
West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast
yeah.
to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'm fine.
It's so good to hear such an incredible story tonight, because so much of what he is saying I have experienced in my linking back to my ancestry. Earlier on, he was talking about reincarnation, having come back, but we're remembering. Well, the word religlio means to link back to your ancestral wisdom. And when I was 30 years old, I went through what is called a spontaneous raising of kundalini, and I ended up with second-degree burns on my body. And 40 days later, I could read the tarot. But it came to me in symbolism. And I'm passing this one thing on about, if you take the Star of David and pose it on a clock, it intersects at every 12 points. Those 12, if you add up all the numbers on the clock, it's 78, which are the 78 cards in the tarot. But if you do them from the 12 and you go 11 and 1 and 10 and 2 and 9 and 3 and so forth, you end up with 6 at the bottom, 72, which are the 72 names of God in Kabbalism, and then 6 being here upon the earth plane. So I've been prompted to give him something for his deciphering these things. So much I could talk about at this point.
Well, we don't have that much time left, unfortunately. But there seems to be some kind of tie-in with a lot of this, Maurice.
Yes, and those were particularly interesting experiences, let me say. And lots of people are experiencing them. Of course, the Orthodox scientific community are not orientated to accept this work. The minds don't work this way. The hearts are not ready for it. But there are lots of experiences people are having. And I never cease to be amazed. I actually witnessed the reincarnation of a soul some months back. But I'd rather not go into it, because the people who are involved in it aren't aware of it. And they're not the sort of people who could come to terms with it. But just when I think I've discovered everything and seen everything, something else happens, which just blows me away, if you like. And it seems that we are having these messages through us constantly, every day and every night. Some of us are able to detect these messages. We're tuned into them. And some of us are not. but it's an ancient language of numbers. It's always numbers, and some would say coincidence, but of course it's not coincidence. It's actually pre-orchestrated.
East of the Rockies, your turn. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George. This is Troy from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Oh, hi, Troy.
Hey. Hey, Maurice, I have a question for you.
Yep.
Excuse me. Notwithstanding that our spirits will survive the big switch of the Earth, would it be beneficial for us to be in an airplane or an orbit or even perhaps on another planet to survive this?
I doubt it, Troy, because all the ancient civilizations have told us that destruction has come previously on four occasions in the last 25,000 years. And on each occasion, it was solar-inspired earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and so on. And that we are now living in the fifth age of the sun. I don't think there will be any physical life left when it comes. But the spiritual side is much more important. The souls will be released. Some souls will go to heaven, some souls will come back, some will go to purgatory to suffer a little more. But clearly the higher voltage we are will help. So every ounce of purification, if you like, helps. And I can't see that there's... I mean, the Book of Revelation says that there will be nowhere to hide when the end comes.
Maurice, like, is it possible when the Mayan calendar ended at 2012 that they just never finished it for whatever reason, that the calendar makers, just something happened to them and nobody completed it?
No, because, you know, people say if they were so clever, why didn't they leave the planet, go on to a different planet and reestablish themselves there? Because one of the fundamental tenets they were trying to convey to us was that physical life is mundane, dull, boring, and a waste of time. I mean, they didn't want to stay here. So when the end came, they were happy to leave. And in so doing, they were trying to tell us that spiritually we're not dead. Just like on the battlefield when Arjuna kills the soldiers, they're not dead. He's simply releasing their souls.
Well, Maurice, we are out of time, unfortunately. I'll tell you what, we've got 8.5 years to worry about this, don't we?
We do have, yes.
Well, we're going to monitor it, and we'll probably have you back on about 8.5 more times before the end of that, as we get closer to it.
Thanks very much, George.
I hope it's a peaceful ending for all of us, don't you?
Let's hope so.
Maurice Cottrell is my guest. Fascinating guy, huh? Stick around tomorrow night. Talk about a haunted house. The scary stuff. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, the webmaster, Barbara Simpson, and always Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there, be safe. Remember the troops. So close to Baghdad.